Spektakulär. Eltern erkunden Autismus.
Ja, heute mit der autistischen Psychologin und Autorin Maja Tudel aus Dänemark.
Today with the autistic psychologist and author Maja Tudel from Denmark by my side.
Und mit Bo Helskov-Elven, Psychologe und Autor aus Schweden.
And with Bo Helskov-Elven, a psychologist and author from Sweden.
Herzlich willkommen zu unserer ersten internationalen Podcast-Folge.
A warm welcome to our first international podcast episode.
Wir werden heute unterstützt durch ein aufmerksames Dolmetscherinnen-Duo, das ich gerade schon kurz im Ohr gehört habe und deswegen kurz irritiert innegehalten habe. Daran werden wir uns aber gewöhnen, hoffe ich.
We're being supported today by an attentive pair of interpreters. I just heard them briefly in my earpiece, which is why I paused for a moment, but I hope we will get used to it. And by a wonderful audience here at the International AUTEA Conference, Autism in Dialogue in Bielefeld.
Dankeschön. Unser Thema heute ist die autismusfreundliche Kommunikation.
Our topic today is autism-friendly communication, or as we've called it, talk out loud, but calmly. It's about communicating and being together, autistic and non-autistic people, especially within families. How can we better attune to each other? How do we do this as professional support providers? How can autistic people make their needs and wishes clear to us? With the two of you, we're bringing together a wide range of perspectives. First, that of the psychologist who is autistic herself and also mother. Then, that of one of the best-known experts on handling challenging situations calmly in everyday care settings. Then there's Marco's perspective from autism therapy and crisis intervention, and our shared experience working with parents and in parent self-help groups. I thought we'd start with a practical example. There's one in your book here, Act, Evaluate and Change, that really resonated with me because I've experienced something similar myself with my son. It's the example of Pernilla, who keeps pestering her caregiver with the same question over and over.
Das ist das Beispiel von Pernilla, die ihre Betreuungsperson mit der ständig gleichen Frage nervt.
Yes.
It's so nice to see the smile coming to your face. Marco, willst du mal dieses kurze Beispiel aus dem Buch eben vorlesen?
Marco, could you read this short example from the book for us?
Yes. Achso,
dafür muss ich dir das bringen. Oh Gott, jetzt muss ich hier meine ganze Gerätschaft
mit. Oh my goodness, now I have to move all my equipment over there.
Ja, danke schön. Yes, thank you.
Guck mal hier.
Yep.
From here to here?
So, Pernilla fiel ja dadurch auf, dass sie ständig dieselbe Frage stellte, hast du gesagt. Dies wiederholte sich mehrmals am Tag. Pernilla stood out because she kept asking the same question as you mentioned. She did this multiple times a day. And it didn't matter if she had already asked the same person.
Und es spielte keine Rolle, ob sie die Frage derselben Person bereits gestellt hatte.
Sie fragte immer nach dem Wochentag, das muss man vielleicht noch dazu sagen.
She always asked about the day of the week. We should probably mention that.
Yes, about the day of the week.
Ja, nach dem
Was
Wochentag.
Was haben wir heute für einen Tag?
What day is it today?
Montag, ne? Nee, Dienstag.
Monday, right? Tuesday.
Und wenn es ausgestrahlt ist, ist es auch Dienstag.
And when it's broadcast, it will be also Tuesday.
Montag, ja gut. Jetzt bin ich wieder völlig konfus. Ich fange mal an, ja?
Now I'm completely confused. Let me start again, okay?
Also dies wiederholte sich mehrmals am Tag.
So, this happened several times a day. And it made no difference if she had already asked the same person. The carers had tested different ways. They answered the question. They showed Pernilla the weekly schedule. Here, Monday, Tuesday. So, right? They ask counter questions like, so which day do we have today? And usually, Pernilla would answer with the correct day. Some had tried ignoring and not answering her. This had the effect that Pernilla became pushy and kept repeating her question. After a few months, the carers began avoiding Pernilla. They pretended not to notice her at all, hoping that Pernilla would stop with the constant questions about the day of the week. But it didn't happen. Pernilla only changed the question. Do you have a pussy or a dick? Some in the carer group decided to totally ignore Pernilla, even when she asked this. After a few weeks, Pernilla started grabbing the carers between the legs.
Nach einigen Wochen griff Pernilla den Betreuerinnen zwischen die Beine.
Yes. And it's not that uncommon. The thing is that to understand this behavior, we need to understand a personality concept called extroversion. Extroversion works like this, that if you're low on extroversion, then you think within yourself. And if you are high, you only think when you talk to people. So you need to be mirrored by other people in order to understand them. And most of us, it's a normal distribution, most of us are in the middle. In average, autistic people are a little bit below the normal distribution's normal mean. So most autistic people are a little more on the introvert side. But there are some who are extroverts. And then there's a problem too, because this scale, when you're a little on the extrovert side and you get stressed, you need more support. If you're a little on the introvert side and you get stressed, you go away from people. So we say that in autism we have two bubbles, a big one and a small one. And the small one here, that we call them autistic extroverts. So it's a personality factor that is from the normal. Everybody has at some level of extroversion. But if it's highly extrovert and poor social skills, of course there's a problem. What she wants to do is she wants to talk to people. Mm-hmm. So she wants small talk. And then she asks, what day is it today? And people say Tuesday. And she likes that question because she knows the answer, because she doesn't like surprises. So of course she'll ask a question she knows the answer for in order to small talk. But the staff, they think that she's communicating. They think that she wants to know and that she's unsure. So they make a schedule and they say, go and see. And that's not what she wants. She wants to talk. So she says, what day is it today? And they say, Tuesday. And then after some time, she said, that was not a very good conversation. I'll try again. What day is it today? And they'll say, Tuesday. And it didn't. The quality of the small talk is actually quite low. So in order to get a better quality, we need to talk differently. What day is it today? Tuesday. What day is it today? What was it? I think I forgot. It's Tuesday. Yes, it's Tuesday. What do you do on Tuesdays? Suddenly we have small talk. And that's what she needs. And when what happens here, some people say we should ignore the behavior because then she will stop. It's called killing the behavior. It's a behavioristic concept. And then that means that you'll take her need for small talk will just be killed there. And you need to understand an extrovert person needs another person to mirror them in order to understand that they exist. When we stop talking to them, she'll feel like she's disappearing. And that's why she'll go to questions that will kick a little harder. And if that doesn't work, she'll grab or something like that. And the behaviors we have in this group, it's same question all the time. It's pinching, especially here. Any of you tried that? That really works, doesn't it? Yeah. Grabbing is one of them. Taking people's glasses, that's very effective as well. But they do it in order to get get other people to react to them. So they're looking for reactions because that's what small talk is. Small talk is giving and taking in turn taking. And when nothing else works, you can take their glasses and break and something will happen. It works every time. The thing here is that Daniel Rippon, he's a British psychologist, he did a PhD where he looked at stress factors in staff. And the most stressing factor in staff was other staff, of course. But the second most was people asking the same question again. And they measured stress in stress hormone in hair. So it was actually, they could measure that. If you work with somebody who asks the same question every time, your staff get very stressed. But I think it's because they didn't understand the situation. When I work with people like that, we find a way of talking to the person. And we also think, yes, we shouldn't react so much to the behavior, but we need to fill the need, and hopefully beforehand. So we try to do a lot of things that makes the person laugh, that makes them interact with the person in a good way. And that's time consuming, but they're time consuming anyway. So it doesn't matter. It's just better to do it on beforehand because our social initiatives have a higher quality than her social initiatives. So we want to communicate with her on beforehand. And then something happens. It's in a staff group, if you have one of these people and she comes into the room, staff turns their back. And they do it because it's difficult. So they work with I call it working with the back against the person. And what happens is that they hope that she'll contact somebody else. And that means that when she contacts somebody else, they won't answer because they're hoping somebody else will answer her. So everything gets very slow around her and she gets very frustrated. And that's when the behavior goes up. So what we need to do is, if I'm in charge, I'm in charge for an hour. I answer every question. I try to make a good conversation. I really concentrate on her. And then all the rest, they don't have to think about it. And then after 1 hour, another one is it. And that means I can relax and the other person gives full attention. And then people say, but that's a lot of attention. Yes, but she's taking that attention anyways. So we better put it high quality because then we might be able to do 10 minutes and then 20 minutes when we don't have to do it and then 10 minutes again and then 20 minutes because it's a need that we need to fulfill.
Wie hast du diese Geschichte empfunden?
Maya, how did this story resonate with you? I noticed that you were really following along. Were you able to relate to Pernilla and understand how she might feel when that happens?
Wie sie sich vielleicht dann fühlt, wenn das passiert.
You know, I very much agree with Bo. I think she's looking for connection. She's looking to be a part of a social group, and she doesn't know how. And so, because she doesn't have the strategies to do it in a way that the staff might find more interesting or engaging or likable, then she pivots the other way to something she does know how to do. But the fact is, if she doesn't have the strategies, then someone else has to either have or get the strategies and implement them for her and help her. Because what she's looking for is that human connection. And when we punish that seeking of attention with ignoring it, with turning our backs physically to a human being who's looking for connection, who's looking for a very basic human need, then we're punishing something that's just human. Mm-hmm. And we're punishing her not having the strategy. Maybe it's the autistic and not the professional part of me that's reacting right now, but I find it cruel.
It is very cruel.
And so I would really look for, as you say, like try to find other ways to respond to her questions. See if you can meet that need for conversation that she doesn't maybe know how to have, but also then be very aware that some days she may or may not have the capacity for the unpredictability of new responses to her question. So some days she might react very positively to, oh, well, you know, it is Tuesday. What do we normally do on Tuesdays? Or some other variation. And some days that might be too much. And she's just looking for, it's Tuesday. Oh, right. Yes, I know it's Tuesday. What day is it? It's Tuesday. Yes, it's Tuesday. Some days that may be her capacity, and that's okay too. But she's still just wanting to connect and feel like she's a part of something. A part of the herd.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Und wahrscheinlich auch Sicherheit haben.
And probably she also gets a sense of security from being able to say that, right?
Also Sicherheit dadurch bekommen, dass sie das sagen kann, oder?
Yes, and that she's allowed to seek that connection, that she is allowed to be a part of, and that she won't be excluded for trying. Mm-hmm. And actually, this is something that's interesting. We do know that there are some autistic people who are very introverted and don't seek social connection that much. But there are actually also studies that show that in autistic and non-autistic interaction, it's very often the non-autistic people who reject the social initiative of autistic people. So it's not just that we don't want to be social, it's also that we really have so much experience of being rejected. And I think that applies to any group within, any subgroup within autistic people.
I think in the part of the autistic society that has the ability to have a job and, you know, function quite well in society, when you have this discrepancy between your social need and your social abilities, it does the bigger the difference, the more the suffering. So I find that group to be the most depressive.
Absolutely.
The most anxiety. Mm-hmm. I worked with a guy, he was very into music, and he would always talk about music, and everybody didn't like to talk about music all the time. So he had trouble having friends, and he was very on people in a way that was not working very well. And then we thought he needs the job. So we got him a job at a record store at the time. You know, I'm old. There used to be record stores, you know. Yeah. But he was working in a record store. But the thing is there, he didn't want to sell people the records they wanted. Because there were more contact in saying, that's shitty music. You should listen to this one instead. So 2 weeks he had a job, and then he got fired again there. So there was so much suffering because in every situation he comes into, mm-hmm. he has a tendency to blow it up, mm-hmm. because he goes for the best emotional contact.
Bei uns, habe ich ja gesagt, war das ja bei unserem Sohn ganz ähnlich.
As I mentioned, it was always very similar with our son. He'd ask that annoying questions every morning to all the teachers at school. And the ones our son got along with well anyway, it didn't bother them at all. They said, why shouldn't I answer? He's a nice guy and funny. We always joke about it. Others turned it into a huge problem and approached me as a mother saying, this isn't going over well with the other kids. They find it annoying too, and they make fun of it. So we have to make sure he changes his behavior. And then it all lands on me as a mother. And then I'm in this kind of mediating role, which has always really bothered me, because I thought, how do people come to the conclusion that it's about changing his behavior so that it no longer annoys anyone as a teacher? The question I wanted to ask now is, as parents, we experience this at home with our children too. They like to monologue. They sometimes talk our ears off, or as we say in Germany, talk a fridge to our ear about the favorite topic. And we'd also like to get to a point where we can have a dialogue, a real back and forth, where our children might also ask us a question once in a while. How do we get there?
Dass unsere Kinder uns vielleicht auch mal eine Frage stellen. Wie kommt man dahin?
Yeah. For me, that behavior is very much a result of the disability. That means if we want to change the behavior, we need to change the disability, and that's not possible. So for me, it's totally about adapting. It's about understanding that's the thing that he does. We need to adapt to it in a way that works. Another example, I live in the city of Malmö in Sweden. Malmö is one of Europe's most diverse cities when it comes to ethnicity. Sweden, we have two cities in Sweden that are extremely diverse. One is Södertälje, where 80% of the population is Arabic, and Malmö is about 50% of everybody who lives in the city. Is 350,000 people are born outside of Europe. I live there, it's a fantastic city. But we had one problem with this guy, and that was that he would, in order to get contact, and he would sneak his hand in between the buttocks of men and then squeeze. but only on black-haired men. And that was because in some cultures there's a little more of a macho ideal. We had a lot of people from South America, we had a lot of Arabic people, and they would react a lot better, he thought. So if it was a blonde guy, he wouldn't do it. So, of course, he understood that there's a difference between people. He just thought it was hair color. But he would go and squeeze their parts. And what we did there was whenever a black-haired guy got a job there, we would give him a protection he could wear for the first 2 months. And then he would do it maybe 5 times and nothing happened, and then he would just stop on that person. And then we could start working with how can we then connect with him in a good way. Because if he didn't want to go behind you, you could connect with him. But otherwise, he was just trying to get behind you, and that was difficult when you started to work with him. But we need to understand it's part of the disability. We cannot change that. So we need to adapt to it in a way so we can start working. And that's very important, I think. So it's about adapting. It's quite simple. And for me, as a neuropsychologist, it's not difficult. I do not want to train people. I want to make people, give them the right to be whoever they are. And then they can decide if they want to train something. I think that's very important. And most kids want to train things, so it's not a problem. But we just need to grab those moments and start training. But I would never say he needs to train that. That's not my job. My job is to say he has human rights, and one of them is autonomy. Autonomy is the basic human right. So if that's what he wants to do, we need to be able to adapt to it in a way so it's not a problem for us, so we can actually work. And that means we might do some things like give protection to some staff, and that's it. And then we see how things develop. That's what I would do.
I think it's also sometimes just recognizing that asking the same question over and over again or doing the same thing over again is one of the ways that we feel safe in a very unpredictable world. Sometimes other people can find something we do annoying, but for us it's just, it feels safe. I know this example is much milder, but I had a series of cartoons that I would watch over and over and over again as a child. I don't know how many hundreds of times I watched those VHS tapes, and I don't know how much my mother hated it. But it felt safe to me. I knew exactly what was going to happen, when it was going to happen. I knew what the characters were going to say and the sounds that were coming and when they would shout and when they would speak softly. I knew exactly what would happen. I knew those movies by heart. And I think if I watched them today, I would still largely know them by heart. And I haven't watched them in 30 years, you know. It can seem annoying and sometimes disruptive even, but it's safe for us. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Adapt. Absolutely. Figure out why are we doing it?
Yeah, and I also think it's actually a common thing. Mm-hmm. People without autism also wants the safe.
Yeah. Yeah. The predictable.
We like that.
Yeah. You love it actually.
We just see it's more important in the autistic world, and it might be a different activity for the safety, but mm-hmm. but the concept is human.
It's completely the same.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Als ich Marco dieses Beispiel rausgesucht habe aus dem Buch.
When I picked out this example from the book for Marco, it reminded you of a situation that really upset you as a father and as someone who also works in schools as a consultant. When that teacher once said, I can't let that slide, I have to save face here.
Ich muss hier mein Gesicht wahren, hat dieser Typ zu dir gesagt.
Oh, I see.
Dass diese Haltung von Menschen dahinter.
Yeah. That attitude people have behind the scenes, which is completely at odds with simply thinking in a practical way.
Völlig dem entgegensteht, einfach nur praxisorientiert zu denken.
Ja, gut, ich dachte, du meinst gerade ein anderes Beispiel, was meinen Sohn betrifft.
Yeah, okay, I thought you were referring to a different example involving my son, since we are also speaking as parents. I can briefly come back to that teacher. He said, well, the girl has to finish her task first, and then she'll get her sticks, which she loves to play with. Those were clearly fidget toys or STEM tools, I assume. And then I said, what if she doesn't do that? Well, then we do a bit of didactic gymnastics and pretend to finish the task. And then she gets the sticks because, you know, we have to save face. I give him a bit of strange look and said, but what if those are her STEM tools? The ones that give her a sense of security and help her process all the sensory input. It's kind of telling someone in a wheelchair, just leave the wheelchair here, go to the door or over there, and you get it back. It's like taking away someone's crutches or assistive device. For example, taking my hearing aids and saying, now, let's listen. And then you can put them back on. Thanks.
Meinetwegen mir die Hörgeräte abnehmen und sage, jetzt hör mir mal zu. Und danach kannst du wieder aufsetzen. Danke.
Und an welches Beispiel hattest du gedacht mit deinem Sohn? An welches Erlebnis, was du gerade meintest?
Das passte nochmal in diese Unterbrechung, die du gerade geschildert hast.
And what example were you thinking of with your son? What experience were you referring to just now?
That actually fits right into an interruption you just described, Maya. When you couldn't finish watching those movies, it took me a long time as a father to realize that my son also needed a transition period. When I picked him up from his playgroup and he was still playing, while I'd come home from work feeling a bit stressed and annoyed, so I'd say, come on, get ready, we need to go. And then all hell broke loose. He would regularly run away and scream, no, Dad, I don't want to, I don't want to. Because he was still in the game he just gotten into, where he felt safe. And then I come in and rip him out of it. Until I had an idea. I would come in first, say hello, let him know I'm there. And I would go to the others first. So he would just notice me and maybe already know we're be leaving soon. But at that point, I didn't know yet that he was on a spectrum. That realization came a few years later because I kept having these conflicts and thought, this reminds me of my clients. Maybe he's autistic too. I kept trying to understand what makes my children feel safe. And what do they need for these transitions? Such as much more time. And that leads me to ask you, how can we take that we've just discussed on a professional level and apply it to the parental level? That parents get an idea of how they can communicate in a way that's understandable and also understand the child's way of communicating. Because all the screaming and refusing is also a form of communication.
Dieses Rumschreien, sich verweigern, ist ja auch eine Kommunikation.
Right, so it depends on the particular behavior. Obviously, some behaviors are more extreme and you need to sometimes act quickly. I have a toddler and toddlers do crazy things. Regardless of whether they're autistic or not. And sometimes you have to do something very, very quickly to prevent a child from getting hurt, and they don't like it, but you just have to. So in situations that are, if there's anything that's dangerous, you step in first. And then we figure out how to resolve the situation. If it's not immediately dangerous, then we go back into trying to understand why is the child reacting that way. So I'm going to use a personal example, and this is very mild. I don't actually know if my daughter's autistic yet. I very much think she's maybe inherited my ADHD, but we'll see. She sometimes will get access to an iPad at grandma's place, and she will get very upset if you turn it off. Well, of course, because you're interrupting what she's doing. But if you give her the option of turning it off herself, she can do it. It's about where can we understand why the reaction is coming, and how can we give the person, regardless of age, regardless of support needs, how can we give them the autonomy to act, to have some control in the situation? Usually you'll find that any reaction is decreased. So autonomy, self-determination, it's key all the time. And as we get older, of course, having more of that self-empowerment becomes more important. Like it needs to expand with development. So it's also allowing yourself sometimes to challenge, am I keeping the child back by not giving them more autonomy, and sometimes giving more and teaching more and being in that, even though it's difficult.
I also think we need to understand the concept of autonomy. Deasy and Ryan, who formulated what we call self-determination theory, they say autonomy is a feeling. For example, I drove down here in my car. So yesterday morning, I went out to my car, and then I made the first decision. Do I drive on the right side of the road or the left side of the road? No, I didn't. There was no option there. I drove on the right side of the road because in Germany, Denmark, and Sweden, it's right side of the road, the countries I was driving through. The next decision was when I came to the first crossroads. It was a crossover where I had the triangle. Then I had to decide, should I respect the triangle or should I just go? No, I respected the triangle. So all the way down here, I followed most of the rules. Did I have autonomy in the car? Did I decide where to go? No, Marika did. Did I decide which way to take? Yes, but I use a GPS so I know where there's Stau, you know, in Hamburg. You know how Hamburg is, right? Yeah, so I trust the GPS. So what is left of my autonomy? I can decide what music to listen to, but only if I'm alone in the car. Because I play music, and I play old music from the 1850s to the 1900s. That's my special interest. And there's a lot of recordings of the same song, so I make playlists with just one song and 50 different versions, and I listen to them again and again and again. And nobody can do that except me. So that means I can never listen to my music when there's other people in the car, because then I'm actually limiting their autonomy, and I'm not supposed to do that. That's not autonomy. So I had the only autonomy I had because I was alone in the car, I could decide the music. But I felt like I'm the king of the Autobahn because I have 428 horsepower I do not use. That's the sense of autonomy. And I think a lot of autism pedagogics is about finding how we can give people a sense of autonomy, because we actually need frameworks to do that. Because if I didn't have the traffic rules, I would never go to Bielefeld. I would only come 200 meters and then we'd crash and nothing happened.
And that's the thing.
Yeah.
Because you do have the autonomy to drive on the left side, but there would be consequences.
Yes.
And you wouldn't like those consequences.
No, of course. So I choose, and that's the point, choosing the structure in order to actually get a feeling of autonomy.
And choosing the thing where you get positive social feedback. And and this is not a thing of talking about reward and punishment, but more so that when things work for all of us, they work for all of us. Hey, wow, this is great. We get to do this thing where nobody gets mad at each other. That's awesome. And that works for a social animal like us. So it's about showing also what are the options for doing the thing in a different way that others are going to respond positively to.
Durch unsere besondere Kommunikationssituation jetzt gerade hier bei der Aufzeichnung.
It's a unique situation here during this recording, where we are listening for long stretches without interrupting. So we need to quickly coordinate internally about which direction you want to take now, Marco, and which question I still see as open regarding mutual dialogue. I asked about that earlier.
Da hatte ich vorhin was nachgefragt.
Ich habe tatsächlich noch was genau zu diesem Thema Autonomie und Struktur.
I actually do have something to add on the topic of autonomy and structure. I'd like to dig a little deeper.
Yes.
What was your question again?
Welche Frage hattest du denn?
Nee, ich hatte vorhin eine Frage gestellt, wie ich es als Mutter schaffe.
I asked a question earlier about how, as a mother, I can manage to engage in a back and forth conversation with my child, who always just monologues. And I think we haven't quite gotten to answering that question yet. And it's very important to me. But I can also ask later.
Okay.
So we will cut that part out of the short version.
Aber die kann ich auch danach stellen. Dann schneiden wir das hier in der Kurzfassung raus.
Naja.
Und bleiben jetzt kurz bei dem Thema, das ihr gerade habt.
And stick briefly with the topic you're discussing right now. But I just wanted to come back to that, to talking with one another, which is our topic today.
Miteinander reden, was wir heute als unser Thema haben.
Vielleicht passt das auch ein bisschen zusammen.
Maybe this also ties in a bit. You asked how we can turn the conversation into a reciprocal dialogue without overly interfering with the autonomy of a child who monologues. And at the same time, this reciprocity does need a structure. What I understood from you, Maya and Bo, is that this structure means I could choose to drive on the left, maintaining my autonomy, but that would lead to painful consequences. But the structure, meaning choosing to drive on the right instead, gives me the autonomy to enjoy the music I've chosen. And perhaps that's the balance between structure, not as a restriction, but as a secure framework that enables autonomy. And that's how I understood it from you. And this connects to the question, how do we invite a child who monologues, which they often do for reasons of security, to feel safe or comfortable, but also how can we invite them into a structure of reciprocity? I think this is often an interesting question for parents.
Das ist, glaube ich, oft eine spannende Frage für Eltern.
Yes, I have an autistic son. When he was a teenager, he was very interested in computer gaming. And he could talk about that. And he could talk about other things for about 2 minutes, and then we talked about computer gaming again. Then at the age of 25, he was working as a support worker at the hospital where he was working with people's computer problems. And then he suddenly said one day, I'm not interested in computers anymore, he said. I'm interested in trees. And then he educated himself to an arborist. He has started climbing trees as a sport called tree climbing. He actually became both the Swedish and the Danish number one in both Sweden and Denmark because he's got double citizenship. So he competed for one time for Sweden in the European Masterships and one time for Denmark also. And he became wide. He had spaghetti arms, and then 10 years later he was this wide. And then 3 years ago he said, "I'm not interested in trees anymore. I'm interested in electric cars." So now he's an engineer, and he and I are building a Fiat Topolino from 1938 into an electric car. We have a workshop together. And I like this interest because I'm interested too. But my experience with him is that he monologues, and I need to be interested in what he's interested in order to get, in order to talk to him. I cannot say we should train him in reciprocity. He can do that, no problem. He does it on the internet all the time with all his Asperger friends. It's not a problem. He lives a very different life than I do. He lives in an apartment with his wife and his girlfriend and his wife's boyfriend. And it's a different life. They like board games and, you know, And I need to be interested in what he's interested in, because he cannot be interested in what I'm interested in, because he's got a disability. But as long as I need to invade his interest, then I become somebody he wants to talk to. So I need to make myself worth talking to. I think that's important. And then we can talk about other stuff when I'm enough interested in what he's interested in. Yeah. And once in a while we can have that other talk, but only once in a while.
Also, eintauchen in die Spezialinteressen.
So immersing ourselves in the special interests, because that creates intrinsic motivation for a conversation, yes?
Ins Gespräch zu kommen, oder?
Ja, und vielleicht nicht so unbeholfen das machen, wie das in unserem, vielleicht kennt ihr unseren Trailer, da erzählt uns Martin.
Yes, and maybe not doing it so clumsily, like maybe you know our trailer, where Martin, he was our second guest on the podcast, told us about this in a test podcast. He was also a computer nerd, and his mother always used that as an excuse to get household chores done and so on. But one day she just suddenly sat down on the edge of his desk and said, "Tell me, what are you doing there?" And he was completely flustered. What does she want from me? Why is she suddenly showing up here? And her interest didn't seem genuine to him at that moment.
Ihr Interesse war nicht ehrlich in dem Moment, für ihn erkennbar.
Exactly. Exactly. I think it's a simple thing in that for most people. If people are interested in me, of course I want to talk to them. And if you have difficulties in the social realm, of course we need to immerse ourselves in that world in order to be predictable. And only when you're predictable, you can be talked to.
And when you're interesting.
Yeah.
And let's face it, there comes a point in a child's life where parents just aren't interesting, and we're not going to talk to you for about 10 years. And that's not autism. That's just development. but I think for autistic children, there's also the aspect of, and I hate to broach this, but usually there's more than one autistic person in a family, and I really don't like the term lack of reciprocity. I really don't like the term, but that can exist in more than one person in a family. And when it does, and when we're stressed, by the way, it doesn't matter what neurotype we have, we become more rigid and we become less flexible to have conversations with. So I think when you're expecting a child to not monologue, you have to recognize, firstly, why are they monologuing? Are you interesting to talk to about other things? Are you perhaps trying, or does it feel like to them that you are trying to push a topic onto them that they are very much not interested in, and that actually feels rigid to them? And then add, what's the current stress level? Is the child stressed? Are you stressed? How is that entering the conversation? So if you're trying to avoid the monologues, you have to create an environment in which there's an alternative. And sometimes that's difficult, but that's okay too.
Daniel Stern had a good concept. He said, he's a psychologist, he said, attunement, you need to tune in. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about the attunement of affect with the baby. Mm-hmm. But I think with an autistic person, yeah, no matter the age, you need to tune in. Mm-hmm. We need to be on the same wavelength. And I've learned that with my son. When he was interested in computer playing, I do not play computer. I have a disability of balance, so I cannot look at the screen where things are moving, because then I fall over. So I had to read about his games. But if I didn't know the game, I was not worth talking to. So I needed to know the games. And then I talked to people and I say, "Oh, my son, he's only playing computer games." And I ask, "What game is he playing?" "I don't know, computer," they say. And I say, "Stupid you. Of course you need to understand what game he's playing. There's so many different games, there's so many different ways of gaming, and you need to understand why is he interested in gaming? Is it the social part? Is it the winning part? What part is it? Because if you want to give him an alternative, it must fill the same needs that the game does. So you need to get interested in order to talk to him at all, but also in order to present alternatives. Tune in.
And also by getting interested, maybe you will learn some of the value that they get from it and recognize that it's not a wasteful thing for them to put time into. You know, no, but I get a lot of this with parents and their children playing computer games. And I always try to acknowledge that sometimes computer gaming can become an addiction and it can be harmful in some ways. And there are certainly also communities in gaming that are not great. But the opposite is also true. So I play World of Warcraft. I've played World of Warcraft since it was launched, so more than 20 years. And I'm a part of a guild, and we meet up. I haven't been there for a while because I had a kid, but we meet up otherwise every year in real life. And we come from all over Europe, and we meet up, and we socialize. These are real friends. When I had my child, I had postpartum depression, and I wrote with my guild what I was going through. And one of them from England and one of them from Holland dropped what they were doing and came to Denmark to live with me for a week to support me. And so these communities also exist. And I think sometimes by not engaging with our children's interests, we can forget to see what positives they might be getting from it. And sometimes those can be skills. Sometimes they are real friendships, even though they exist online. Sometimes it's something we can't measure. But if we pay attention, we'll see it.
I never understood when my boy was a child that tree climbing could be a career. So I never supported him in tree climbing when he was 10 years old. But he actually made a living off it for 10 years.
Yeah.
So sometimes we need to understand everything is good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Als unser Sohn ganz klein war, ich lasse dich gleich, Marco. When our son was very young, I let you continue, Marco. I once emailed an autistic psychologist after finding an article by him in a thick book on autism at the city library. And I asked him, how do I start a conversation with my child? And he said, only through his special interests. So actually, I already knew the answer. But I found yours to be much more profound. It went much deeper.
Eigentlich kannte ich die Antwort schon, aber ich fand eure noch viel tiefgründiger und ging mehr in die Tiefe. Jetzt bist
also
du, Marco.
Letztlich, ne? Also um das nochmal auf deine Ursprungsfrage zurückzukommen, also dieses...
To come back to your original question from earlier. This aversion we might develop towards monologues actually creates a stressful atmosphere for the autistic child. That might be another opportunity for us as parents to work a bit on our resilience, or rather our acceptance. Resilience certainly plays a role in a certain situations, but acceptance, like, okay, my child likes monologues, they are comfortable with that, means I let them do it. And maybe at some point a window will open, such as through certain games or interests where we can then become part of it. You had something else to add on that?
In den wir dann Teil davon werden. Du hattest davon dazu auch noch was?
Ja, wenn wir daran glauben, dass Entwicklung möglich ist.
Yes, if we believe that development is possible, that's the key. That's also what Imke Heuer, an autistic woman who's been on our podcast before and a scientist, told us. So if we convey to the child that we believe something is achievable, that's the crucial point.
I've lost my train of thought a bit right now. Sorry. It's really hard to stay focused on this situation. Sorry, I just need to be transparent about this for a moment. I wanted to go back to the one point. When we're in a conversation with the children and we notice that our children are starting to get nervous, that the situation is no longer comfortable for them and they'd actually prefer to leave, but we haven't yet reached the point that's really important. So we need to prepare them for something, for example, what they need to know, because otherwise it will become more stressful for them. How can we manage that? Work together to bring that stress level back down a bit. Because you, Maya, are also an expert in stress management.
Gemeinsam wieder etwas runterzukommen von diesem Stresslevel, denn du, Maya, bist ja auch Expertin für Stressmanagement.
So this again very much depends on the child. But one of the first things I tend to give parents is the list of the 10 W's. So these are 10 questions about what are we going to be doing? Who are we doing it with? How long? 10 questions that you can go through and answer so that the child knows exactly like what is expected. And this kind of gives the framework for a little bit calm. Because suddenly we've reduced the unpredictability. What is important to me to include when I give that list, and I didn't come up with it, it's been around for a while. What I tend to tell people is that not all 10 questions will be equally important to each child, or to each autistic person, because sometimes it's adults too. But some questions will be the more important ones to have the answers to. So focus on those. Mm-hmm. Focus on figuring out which ones are important, yeah. Because we can't hold everything in our heads all the time. Yeah. It's too much information. So figure out which are the important questions. And then, of course, I also will go into kind of the energy accounting aspect of things, right? So we know what we're going to be doing. How can we reduce the amount of energy that it costs to do that thing? Do we need any accommodations? Do we need noise-canceling headphones? Do we need any sensory blockers? Do we need what I call an emergency door, a way to leave the situation quickly? What do we need? What supports do we have to put in place? So things like that, I try to talk through, and then, if possible, I always want to include the child in these discussions. I want to know from the child what is it that stresses you out, because sometimes, very often, parents don't know. And actually, when we're talking to the child about what it is that's stressful for them, they'll say something, and the parents go, really? I had no idea. No, it was that simple, actually. If you just did that thing, I could do it.
I also have an answer to that. It's mm-hmm. to complete, a little widen it a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times the things that we think the child needs to do might not be what the child needs to do. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's about what we expect the child to do. As a parent, you need to be extremely open to the child finding its own way. Yeah. And one of the very difficult parts is he's not going to school. He's choosing not to go to school. Mm. And we will start to push, and we will push, and the child will lock himself in the room, and he'll not talk to you for 3 years if you continue pushing. So as a parent, you need to be able to give in. There's a Swedish comedian called Ronny Eriksson, and he says it's never too late to give up. And I think that's a very good principle. Mm. If you now that you really tried and it did not work, now it's the time to give up. It's never too late. Mm-hmm. Because the child will understand when you give up, it's because of him that you accept his choice. Mm-hmm. And I think the most conflicts I've seen between kids and their parents are because the parents have a cultural way of thinking that you should do some things, you should finish school, you mm-hmm. should do this, you should do that.
You should attend that wedding or...
Yeah, exactly. And, whatever. And in my family, because 50% has a diagnosis, of course we have a silent room at every wedding. I mean, otherwise it wouldn't work. And we also have computers for people who didn't bring their own because they might need a computer to sit by to just calm down. Mm-hmm. And so create all the things, like mm-hmm. Maya said, create all the possibilities to make it work. And then remember it's never too late to give in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that's very important because when you give in, the child feels seen. And that's very important.
That's one of the reasons I use this emergency exit strategy is, so I have, in my profile, I have a little bit of the pathological demand avoidance or pervasive need for autonomy.
Exactly. Better word.
Yeah. So the thing is, for me, if I have to go and do something, I always have that sense of I can't, but I can't. And I know I can, but I can't. If I know that there is an option for me to say, I actually can't do it, then I can do so much more. But if I don't have the option of not going to school, if I don't have the option of not inviting my whole class to my birthday party, including the ones that are bullying me, if I don't have the option, then I definitely can't. And then there's just not going to be a birthday party at all. But if I have the option, would you like to do something else? Would you like to have it somewhere else than your house so that your bully can't see your things, can't go into your room? Would you like to structure it differently? Would you like to have a set end time so that you know exactly when they're going to leave? And we always have the option of calling everybody on the day and saying, oh, they got sick. Maya got sick. We don't have the birthday. It's canceled. Even if it's not true. If I know I have the options, then I'm probably actually going to go through with it. And that's the weird thing about the anxiety that sometimes comes along with autism and with a pervasive need for autonomy or just an anxiety about life in general, is that if we know we can say stop when we really mean it, then we won't say stop until we have to. But if we don't have the option, then we're going to say stop all the way. Then we're just not going to cooperate at all.
And then there's a lot of people saying, but shouldn't he learn to continue? And then I always say, no.
No. Why?
No. He should learn to back off when he needs to.
Yeah.
That's a lot better ability to have in your life to say no when you need to than to do things you didn't. I think it's also about obedience. I've met obedient people.
Yeah.
I mean, they are gang members. They're extremely obedient.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want obedient children like that.
No.
And I don't want people to continue, we gave you this job, you should shoot this guy and you need to continue with it. Because I've done a lot of assessments of kids in prison. Autistic kids in prison, and they did things and they never stopped because somebody taught them to never back out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's stupid. I mean, so of course we need to tell people you always have a chance to back out. It's very important.
And to think for yourself, to feel what's going on in you. What do you want, actually? Why do you want that? Of course, again, depending on development, I'm not going to go through that with a three-year-old. We're not there yet. but I think it's very important. I ended up skipping school a lot as a child. It started because of bullying, but then it continued. And throughout throughout elementary school, I was away from school anywhere between 20 and 50% each year. I just wasn't present in school. My grades were fine. I knew how to do the things, but I wasn't in school. And I could have been kicked out of school as a punishment, but what good would that have done, right? Somebody could have looked at that and said, obviously Maya can't do a thing. Obviously she can't show up when she's supposed to. And we have to teach her obedience, or we have to give up on her completely. They could have said that. I could have said that about myself. And now I have a master's degree in psychology, and I'm here, and I help people.
Yeah.
I don't make a living. I never want anyone to think that the disability is gone. It's not. But what I do makes a difference. And I think it's important that we remember that wherever a person is at right now and whatever their support needs are right now, that doesn't mean that that's going to be forever. And it doesn't mean that just because you can't do one thing that you can't do another. So what is it we're expecting of someone that is actually unreasonable? And for me, it was going to school with my bullies. And going to school after learning that that environment was actually hostile to me. Of course I'm not going to go to school. Right.
In welchem Moment warst du in dem Alter, als du die Diagnose bekommen hast, mit 16 oder 17 warst du da?
How old were you when you received your diagnosis? You were 16 or 17 at that time? It must have been a year before that big party.
Es muss ein Jahr vor dieser großen Party gewesen sein.
16.
In welchem Moment warst du bereit, mit deinen Eltern über Autismus zu sprechen?
When were you ready to talk to your parents about autism?
That's trickier. My mother tried to talk about it right away, and I wasn't there. I think mostly because at that time, I felt like, well, I've always known I was different. Now you've just given it a name. I'm fine with that. I don't need to talk about it anymore. I know exactly what I'm like. And then a couple of years passed, and I got more ready to talk about it. But I think I couldn't talk about it with my parents. My dad lives in South Carolina. He's pretty far away. And my mother's perspective on autism is so philosophically different that it was never a conversation. It was a discussion. It was me trying to convince her that I was allowed to be autistic the way I am, and her trying to convince me that I had to fit in to society. And that never resolved.
Das ist nochmal eine andere Reaktion, als ich die zum Beispiel bei meinem Sohn hatte. That's a quite different reaction I had with my son, who, when he was diagnosed at 12, said, oh, that's good then. Then I'm not actually that deaf after all. At first, he was very interested in talking about it, and we had some good conversations. But now at 17, he's like, don't make such a big thing out of it. Just drop it. It's annoying.
Mach das mal nicht alles so groß. Es nervt.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think there's also been a development I've seen in the last few years. Because there was a time period where being autistic was becoming okay. And now I actually see it turning back towards stigma. Amongst young people, I mean. It's becoming more of a bullying word again. And so I actually see the same thing in several of my teenage clients, that they're like, I don't really want anyone to know. And then I have a couple that are in good classes, there's good social culture, and they're fine with being completely open about it. And with them, I will still have that chat to say, okay, well, you can include diagnostic labels if you want to when you talk about something, but you don't have to. You can talk about your support needs however you want. And if they want to use diagnostic labels, go for it. And if they don't, then don't. But yeah, it's very different for each person when they're ready to talk about it with the world and with family members. And I think from the moment I got my diagnosis, I was ready to tell my friends, no problem. But family was different.
Mm-hmm. We have in my town, Malmö, there is every year there's a conference, a furries conference. 6,000 furries in the town, and they have a parade, and it's wonderful. And last time there was interviews with some of them in the newspaper, and one of the leaders says, yes, we come here every year. We came here the last 5 years, and this year we asked 5,000 autistic people at the same place. He said, all furries are autistic, but not all have a diagnosis. But for some of them, it's more difficult to come out as a furry as an autistic person. And for some people, it's furries is a society where you can hide your autism. So we talk about autism like it's a category and it's hard. But you can choose to be a furry and you can choose not to be a furry. You can choose to be an autist and you can choose not to be an autist. In 2013, when DSM-5 came, the diagnosis of Asperger syndrome disappeared. And some people would say, oh no, then I'm going to be autistic instead. And I said, but it's fantastic, because that means now people can decide to be Aspie. Now it's not a diagnostic label anymore. Now it's a cultural label. So like you can choose to be a furry, you can choose to be an Aspie. And in Malmö, where I live, we have an Aspie culture, a very large group. In Malmö, there are some big game developers. So that means they have hundreds of people working, developing computer games. And that culture around them, those companies, it attracts autistic people from all over the world. So there's the autistic subculture is very big in town. We have a big science fiction bookstore and, you know, everything that fits into this autistic way of life that we see in the nerdy autistic people and young people today. And I think it's still a choice, and we need to accept it as a choice instead of just thinking of it from a level of disability. Because for some people it's a disability, for some people it's a disability in some situations. And for some people, the freedom of the autistic society actually means more than anything else. Mm. So we need, even I know, Maya, you say we need different words. As parents, we need to talk about it as a disability, because otherwise we will not get support.
Sometimes we do.
Yeah, but we also need to talk about it as a way of being. A being. I think we need to mm-hmm. keep those two thoughts in our heads at all times.
No, I was mm-hmm. referring specifically when you're navigating systems for support, you can sometimes be forced to change your language.
Yes, and talk about it. But yeah. I think we need to be able to switch between those languages in order to understand the culture around it. Yeah,
definitely. And I think it's important to recognize that We are who we are. We have the brains, the neurotypes that we do. We can't do anything about that. But there is a community out there, and there are sub-communities all over the place that are very autism-friendly, because that's where we gravitate. So we actually become the majority sometimes. Mm. And there are a lot of those spaces where there are diagnostic labels, and then there are some where there aren't. People don't know they're autistic. They just all happen to be quietly somewhere behind. No one might actually have the diagnosis or talk about it, but if you went there as a professional, you would see it everywhere. Mm.
And I think as a professional, when I'm invited into that culture, that's fantastic. And I need to, I need to be very humble about mm. that invitation, because that means somebody thinks that what I do is okay.
Yeah.
And the right people who thinks it, it's the autistic people. So whenever I'm invited in, I see it as a fantastic gift.
It's an honorary card.
It's an honorary card, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Und wenn ich als Mutter weiß, es gibt diese fantastischen Kontexte mit den super netten Leuten, wo du gut hinpasst.
As a mother, I know there are these fantastic settings with really nice people where you'd fit right in. What can I do to nudge my child in that direction? If the child just wants to be like everyone else all the time, like a neurotypical child.
Wie alle anderen, also wie ein neurotypisches Kind.
Ich glaube, es lässt sich nicht stupsen, oder?
Nee.
I don't think you can nudge it.
You can't.
Yes, something. I have a pillow at home I got as a 60-year present from my son and his wife, another son. He's a psychologist, and he knows that I was doing consultancy work where he works, actually. And then I got a question, and I said, sometimes when I get a question, I don't have an answer. And that's because then the question is wrong. So I got this pillow that says, when I cannot answer the question, it's the question that's wrong. And I think it's important, because sometimes we put a question out there that there's no answer to. Mm-hmm. And we need to reformulate it so it creates a possibility for an answer. We cannot continue asking questions there are no answers for. So we need to figure out how to ask a question in a way that there's an answer. So I think it's the wrong question. The wrong question is, how can I push him into that area where he could thrive? No, how can I try to figure out where he could thrive? Because he'll find his own way there. It's just, I need to be open to anything. And I need to open up the possibilities. And then I just need, when he decides, I need to accept. Even though it might not be my culture, what I would choose. And that might be difficult. Sometimes it's, I work with a person, he's got two personas. One is an alcoholic, so he drinks for 2 weeks at a time. He drinks vodka, he starts at 7 o'clock in the morning, every 10 minutes he drinks vodka, until he's got a level, so he goes out and then he sits with the drunkards on the bench. And it's a perfect social setting for him. He actually works in that setting. Everybody screams at people, you know, it works perfectly. But then his body is not so good at drinking. So after 2 weeks, he gets very stressed. So he stops drinking, and then he becomes a Nazi for 2 weeks. So he's a part of he's in the Nazi party for 2 weeks, and he hangs up the swastika on the wall and everything. And it took some time for people around him to accept his two personas. And I do understand none of them is very good for him. But those are the ones he picked, and I worked with him when he lived. He's an adult and he lives in a residential facility, and we try to create others. Where can he get the same thing as he gets now? And now he actually is not a Nazi anymore. He's a communist, because he had a friend whom his neighbor was a communist. Yeah, so they sometimes go out and then they drink alcohol together and then they puke, but only on Mercedes and BMWs. And you know, but that's an interest, and that's a social interest about something. And I need to take down my morality and say, maybe it's not perfect, but maybe it's the best he can do. We can try to find better ways, but it needs to be him that chooses it. And luckily, it's very seldom to have these two interests.
Yeah.
Ganz nüchtern schaue ich auf unsere Uhr und sehe, dass wir schon unser Zeitlimit erreicht haben.
Looking at our clock, totally sober with a clear head, I see that we've already reached our time limit.
Although I could listen to you both for hours. Weil ich könnte euch stundenlang zuhören.
Ich kann aber diese Antwort nicht stehen lassen, ohne zu fragen.
But I can't just leave that answer hanging without asking. Is there a question I can always ask, because it can't possibly be wrong?
Eine Frage, die ich immer stellen kann, weil sie gar nicht falsch sein kann.
What do you want?
Okay.
How would you like me to talk to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you're stressed, what would you like me to do? Mm-hmm. And then he might say, you should do like this, and then
should
it doesn't work. And then you ask again, okay, it didn't work. Then what would you do? Always ask.
If I can tack on to this pushing towards interest thing. I would also say sometimes we don't know what the options are. We know our interest, but we may not know what options there are for a community within that. And what you can sometimes do is introduce a couple of options. Know that they are probably not going to take those options, but then they know it exists. And then, sometime later, they might find their own way. But presenting options and saying, you don't have to do it. This is something that's there. We don't have to. That, I think, is always a good thing.
Mm. Ich glaube, das ist ein guter Abschlusssatz, oder?
Thank you very much.
That's a good closing line, right?
Vielen Dank.
Okay, well, that's...
Miriam, du wolltest noch was sagen.
You wanted to say something else.
Vielen Dank. Thank you very much.
Vielen Dank euch beiden, Maja Tudel und Bo Helskov-Elwin.
Thank you both, Maja Tudel and Bo Helskov-Elwin, for this enriching conversation, for your time and for your willingness to give smart answers, even to silly questions.
Auf doofe Fragen kluge Antworten zu geben. Wer mehr von euch wissen will.
If anyone wants to learn more about you, we recommend your books. I have a whole stack of them here. I will just list all the titles in the show notes, so this episode doesn't get any longer than it already is. But do read the books. They're well worth it. You can also check out their podcasts if you're good at English. Maya's podcast is in English, and your podcasts are in Swedish and Danish. That's a bit more challenging, but maybe you will manage it too.
Das ist ein bisschen schwieriger, aber vielleicht kriegt ihr auch das hin.
Schwedisch.
In unseren Shownotes findet ihr auch noch viele weitere perspektiverweiternde Quellen.
In our show notes, you will also find plenty of other perspective broadening resources to tide you over until our next podcast in a month. This episode, which we're recording here live today, live on tape, will be released on June 30th, by the way. You can listen to it everywhere podcasts are available, Spotify, Apple, Deezer, what else is there?
Apple, was gibt es noch alles? Deezer und YouTube, wie sie nicht alle heißen.
So YouTube.
Und über unsere Website spektakulär.de mit AE geschrieben.
And via our website, of course, spektakulär.de, spelled with AE. And for those who prefer reading over listening, there's always a transcript of our episodes, at least for the longer conversations, so you can read through the conversation again later.
Da kann man das Gespräch dann auch nochmal nachlesen.
Und in verschiedene Sprachen. And in different languages.
Thank you all for listening today.
Vielen Dank euch auch fürs Zuhören heute.
Das war spektakulär. Eltern erkunden Autismus.
Weitere Infos und Links zu dieser Folge findet ihr auf unserer Seite spektakulär.de.
Der Podcast aus dem Martinsclub Bremen. Gefördert durch die Heidehof-Stiftung, die Waldemar-Koch-Stiftung und die Aktion Mensch.
Redaktion und Produktion Miriam Rosentreter. In Zusammenarbeit mit Selbstverständlich, Agentur für barrierefreie Kommunikation.